deference, and incumbent self-protection. Rather than show any deference to a coordinate branch of government, the majority thus rejects the anti-corruption rationale without serious analysis. Today's opinion provides no clear rationale for being so dismissive of Congress, but the prior individual opinions on which it relies have offered one: the incentives of the legislators who passed PCRA. Section 203, our colleagues have suggested, may be little more than an incumbency protection plan, a disreputable attempt at legislative self-dealing rather than an earnest effort to facilitate First Amendment values and safeguard the legitimacy of our political system. This possibility, the court apparently believes, licenses it to run roughshod over Congress's handiwork. In my view, we should instead start by acknowledging that Congress surely has both wisdom and experience in these matters that is far superior to ours. Many of our campaign finance precedents explicitly and forcefully affirm the propriety of such presumptive deference. Moreover, judicial deference is particularly warranted, whereas here we deal with a congressional judgment that has remained essentially unchanged throughout a century of careful legislative adjustment. In America, incumbent legislators pass the laws that govern campaign finance, just like all other laws. To apply a level of scrutiny that effectively bars them from regulating electioneering whenever there is the faintest whiff of self-interest is to deprive them of the ability to regulate electioneering. This is not to say that deference would be appropriate if there were a solid basis for believing that a legislative action was motivated by the desire to protect incumbents or that it will degrade the competitiveness of the electoral process. Along with our duty to balance competing constitutional concerns, we have a vital role to play in ensuring that elections remain at least minimally open, fair, and competitive. But it is the height of recklessness to dismiss Congress's years of bipartisan deliberation and its reasoned judgment on this basis without first confirming that the statute in question was intended to be or will function as a restraint on electoral competition. Absent record evidence of invidious discrimination against challengers as a class, a court should generally be hesitant to invalidate legislation which on its face imposes even-handed restrictions. We have no record evidence from which to conclude that BCRA Section 203, or any of the dozens of state laws that the court today calls into question, reflects or fosters such invidious discrimination. Our colleagues have opined that any restriction upon a type of campaign speech that is equally available to challengers and incumbents tends to favor incumbents. This kind of airy speculation could easily be turned on its head. The electioneering prohibited by Section 203 might well tend to favor incumbents, because incumbents have pre-existing relationships with corporations and unions, and groups that wish to procure legislative benefits may tend to support the candidate who, as a sitting office holder, is already in a position to dispense benefits and is statistically likely to retain office. If a corporation's goal is to induce office holders to do its bidding, the corporation would do well to cultivate stable long-term relationships of dependency. So we do not have a solid theoretical basis for condemning Section 203 as a front for incumbent self-protection, and it seems equally, if not more plausible, that restrictions on corporate electioneering will be self-denying. Nor do we have a good empirical base for skepticism, as the court's failure to cite any imperial research attests. Nor does the legislative history give reason for concern. Congress devoted years of careful study to the issues underlying BCRA. Few legislative proposals in recent years have received as much sustained public commentary or news coverage. Political scientists and academic experts with no self-interest in incumbent protection were central figures in pressing the case for BCRA. And the legislation commanded bipartisan support from the outset. Finally, it's important to remember just how incumbent-friendly congressional races were prior to the BCRA's passage. As the Solicitor General aptly remarked at the time, the evidence supports overwhelmingly that incumbents were able to get reelected under the old system just fine. It would be hard to develop a scheme that could be better for incumbents. In this case, then, there is no convincing evidence that the important interests favoring expenditure limits are fronts for incumbency protection. In the meantime, a legislative judgment that enough is enough should command the greatest possible deference from judges interpreting a constitutional provision that, at best, has an indirect relationship to activity that affects the quantity of repetitive speech in the marketplace of ideas. The majority cavalierly ignores Congress's factual findings and its constitutional judgment. It acknowledges the validity of the interest in preventing corruption, but it effectively discounts the value of that interest to zero. This is quite different from conscientious policing for impermissibly anti-competitive motive or effect in a sensitive First Amendment context. It is the denial of Congress's authority to regulate corporate spending on elections. Austin and corporate expenditures. Just as the majority gives short shrift to the general societal interests at stake in campaign finance regulation, it also overlooks the distinctive considerations raised by the regulation of corporate expenditures. The majority fails to appreciate that Austin's anti-distortion rationale is itself an anti-corruption rationale tied to the special concerns raised by corporations. Understood properly, anti-distortion is simply a variant on the classic governmental interest in protecting against improper influences on office holders that debilitate the democratic process. It is manifestly not just an equalizing ideal in disguise. Section 1, anti-distortion. The fact that corporations are different from human beings might seem to need no elaboration, except that the majority opinion almost completely elides it. Austin set forth some of the basic differences. Unlike natural persons, corporations have limited liability for their owners and managers, perpetual life, separation of ownership and control, and favorable treatment of the accumulation and distribution of assets that enhance their ability to attract capital and to deploy their resources in ways that maximize the return on their shareholders' investments. Unlike voters in U.S. elections, corporations may be foreign-controlled. Unlike other interest groups, business corporations have been effectively delegated responsibility for ensuring society's economic welfare. They inescapably structure the life of every citizen. The resources in the treasury of a business corporation, furthermore, are not an indication of popular support for the corporation's political ideas. They reflect instead the economically motivated decisions of investors and customers. The availability of these resources may make a corporation a formidable political presence, even though the power of the corporation may be no reflection of the power of its ideas. It might also be added that corporations have no consciences, no beliefs, no feelings, no thoughts, no desires. Corporations help structure and facilitate the activities of human beings, to be sure, and their personhood often serves as a useful legal fiction. But they are not themselves members of we the people, by whom and for whom our Constitution was established. These basic points help explain why corporate electioneering is not only more likely to impair compelling governmental interests, but also why restrictions on that electioneering are less likely to encroach upon First Amendment freedoms. One fundamental concern of the First Amendment is to protect the individual's interest in self-expression. Freedom of speech helps make men free to develop their faculties. It respects their dignity and choice, and it facilitates the value of individual self-realization. Corporate speech, however, is derivative speech, speech by proxy. A regulation such as BCRA Section 203 may affect the way in which individuals disseminate certain messages through the corporate form, but it does not prevent anyone from speaking in his or her own voice. Within the realm of campaign spending generally, corporate spending is furthest from the core of political expression. It is an interesting question who is even speaking when a business corporation places an advertisement that endorses or attacks a particular candidate. Presumably, it's not the customers or employees who typically have no say in such matters. It cannot realistically be said to be the shareholders, who tend to be far removed from the day-to-day decisions of the firm and whose political preferences may be opaque to management. Perhaps the officers or directors of the corporation have the best claim to be the ones speaking, except their fiduciary duties generally prohibit them from using corporate funds for personal ends. Some individuals associated with the corporation must make the decision to place the ad, but the idea that these individuals are thereby fostering their self-expression or cultivating their critical faculties is fanciful. It is entirely possible that the corporation's electoral message will conflict with their personal convictions. Take away the ability to use general treasury funds for some of those ads, and no one's autonomy, dignity, or political equality has been impinged upon in the least. Corporate expenditures are distinguishable from individual expenditures in this respect. I have taken a view that a legislature may place reasonable restrictions on individuals' electioneering expenditures in the service of governmental interests explained above, and in recognition of the fact that such restrictions are not direct restraints on speech, but rather on its financing. But those restrictions conceitedly present a tougher case because the primary conduct of actual flesh and blood persons is involved. Some of those individuals might feel that they need to spend large sums of money on behalf of a particular candidate to vindicate the intensity of their electoral preferences. This is obviously not the situation with business corporations, as their routine practice of giving substantial sums to both major national parties makes collusively clear. Corporate participation in elections, any business executive will tell you, is more transactional than ideological. In this transactional spirit, some corporations have affirmatively urged Congress to place limits on their electioneering communications. These corporations fear that officeholders will shake them down for supportive ads, that they will have to spend increasing sums on elections in an ever-escalating arms race with their competitors, and that public trust in business will be eroded. A system that effectively forces corporations to use their shareholders' money both to maintain access to and to avoid retribution from the elected officials may ultimately prove more harmful than beneficial to many corporations. It can impose a kind of implicit tax. In short, regulations such as Section 203 and the statute upheld in Austin impose only a limited burden on First Amendment freedoms, not only because they target a narrow subset of expenditures and leave untouched the broader public dialogue, but also because they leave untouched the speech of natural persons. Recognizing the weakness of a speaker-based critique of Austin, the court places primary emphasis not on the corporation's right to electioneer, but rather on the listener's interest in hearing what every possible speaker may have to say. The court's central argument is that laws such as Section 203 have deprived the electorate of information, knowledge, and opinion vital to its function, and this in turn interferes with the open marketplace of ideas protected by the First Amendment. There are many flaws in this argument. If the overriding concern depends on the interests of the audience, surely the public's perception of the value of corporate speech should be given important weight. That perception today is the same as it was a century ago when Theodore Roosevelt delivered the speeches to Congress that in time led to the limited prohibition on corporate campaign expenditures that is overruled today. The distinctive threat to democratic integrity posed by corporate domination of politics was recognized at the inception of the Republic and has been a persistent theme in American political life ever since. It is only certain members of this court, not the listeners themselves, who have agitated for more corporate electioneering. Austin recognized that there are substantial reasons why a legislature might conclude that unregulated general treasury expenditures will give corporations unfair influence in the electoral process and distort public debate in ways that undermine rather than advance the interests of listeners. The legal structure of corporations allows them to amass and deploy financial resources on a scale few natural persons can match. The structure of a business corporation furthermore draws a line between the corporation's economic interests and the political preferences of the individuals associated with the corporation. The corporation must engage the electoral process with the aim to enhance the profitability of the company, no matter how persuasive the arguments for a broader or conflicting set of priorities. A corporation should have as its objective the conduct of business activities with a view to enhancing corporate profit and shareholder gain. In a state election such as the one at issue in Austin, interests of non-resident corporations may be fundamentally adverse to the interests of local voters. Consequently, when corporations grab up the prime broadcasting slots on the eve of an election, they can flood the market with advocacy that bears little or no correlation to the ideas of natural persons or to any broader notion of the public good. The opinions of real people may be marginalized. The expenditure restrictions of Section 441B are thus meant to ensure that competition among actors in the political arena is truly competition among ideas.